Welcome to the first episode of Agency, a conversation about social change with the people who make it. Each episode I speak with an inspiring change maker as they share their insights, challenges and successes, because each of us has the potential and the agency to change the world. And for our very first episode, I'm delighted to be speaking with Jessica Metcalf, a seasoned animal welfare advocate with nearly two decades of experience in corporate engagement, policy and campaigning. She's currently the Global Program Lead for Animal Welfare in Textiles at Four Paws, and alongside her team, works to drive industry-wide change, challenging major fashion brands to end cruel practices like live lamb cutting and live plucking. Jess has driven some amazing change over her career, and I'm really pleased to be speaking with her today about some of those wins and the learnings she has had along the way. So Jess, thanks so much for joining me today for the first episode of Agency. And our campaigning story goes back quite a few years now, beginning during the time when we worked together at World Animal Protection. And obviously you've done so much since then, and I'm really interested to hear about some of those great campaigns that you've been doing since that time. But if we can start by just casting our minds back to that period at World Animal Protection, and I'd love to hear what from that time stands out to you.
Oh gosh, we really do need to cast our minds back. I think it was at least 15 years now, but what a great time that was. For me, that was my first role, like first professional role as a campaigner, where I was paid to do the work and had, you know, big responsibilities. And you were my line manager. So that was just a brilliant way for me to start that I will always cherish. You had had quite a bit of experience before that, but for me, that was my first entry point. So I really do remember a lot well, because there were so many firsts for me during that time. I think we just did so much thinking of it. We did some really big things. So I think some of our key issues were live export, which is still quite a big issue being talked about still now. Whaling was our other one, and bear bile, all like quite intense issues, lots of animal suffering being caused by those things. I still remember, I think, again, something that sort of stuck with me since then was the idea of collaborating and bringing together all sorts of stakeholders under the common objective of making change together on particular issues, really no matter almost where they sat. And we had some pretty amazing examples there that we could talk about. I think one that is just really interesting was our collaboration with the Australian Meat Industry Employees Union, which our beautiful colleague Amy Firth set up when she was working in our team. Emily, it was something that you had encouraged us all to do all the time, was to find those stakeholders and bring them together.
And of course, Jess, there you're talking about our campaign to end the live export of Australian animals for slaughter. Mm. And specifically, we were focused on the live export of Australian sheep for slaughter in the Middle East, a trade that caused enormous suffering to millions of animals every year. And we'd been campaigning alongside other great animal welfare organisations, Animals Australia, who had done and continue to do incredible and groundbreaking work, difficult work to end this trade. Organisations like RSPCA here in Australia, but also a wide coalition around the world of organisations that were uniting to end the transport and the export of animals for slaughter. So we'd really been focused on demonstrating the animal welfare implications of that trade, and they're significant, and for millions of animals. We'd been looking at Australia's reputation, etc. But what we needed to do was to really tell a different story about why this trade should end. We continued with our welfare arguments, but we needed more in order to reach decision makers, to reach new audiences. And so what we started to look at was the economic story of this trade, that sheep exported for slaughter in another country actually had some really negative implications for Australia. And this connection that we had with the Australian Meatworkers Union was really about demonstrating, well, what's the impact to Australia and to Australian jobs of exporting animals overseas? So towards our goal of ending the trade, but just looking at arguments other than the animal welfare argument, which only goes so far in terms of getting shifting political will or gaining traction. And it was in that notion that we looked to branch out into wider collaborations.
Yeah, I mean, we had events with the Meat Workers Union, and these are people that are union for generally abattoir workers. So quite unlikely bedfellows, but we found our common ground. They were able to or keen to get behind our efforts because they wanted stability of their jobs and making sure the supply chains here were concrete versus going overseas, which worked for them, but it also worked for us because as much as we can talk about suffering, we often do need to talk about economics as well. And they really brought that in. And so we had events with them in Fremantle, in Sydney, in Lismore. I don't know if you remember that with Janelle Stafford opening the forum for us. And I remember Emily Yu speaking alongside Grant from AMIU and Clover Moore. Just seeing all these people come together under one common objective and finding that common ground was something that has very much stuck with me. I don't think I've had such an unusual coalition partner ever since. But that was, you know, it was really an important lesson for me during that time. And I think it really helped us to bring those messages to people that weren't necessarily as receptive of what we were trying to say. And that sort of enabled that.
And it's really that notion of unlikely allies, isn't it? And I think that that's such a wonderful example that you point to. And as you say, on our own, as an animal welfare organisation, I mean, of course, we were vocal. We had the arguments behind us, the animal welfare arguments, but there was a real power in coming together with others, which we know there is strength in numbers of people and organisations. But the added element to that was that these really were unlikely allies. So, you know, from our perspective, of course, we wanted the trade to end from the animal welfare benefits because of the suffering that it caused and causes. But from the Meat Workers Union perspective, they want to protect jobs in Australia. So we were wanting the same goal for different reasons. And I think it certainly was interesting to look at those different perspectives. And I think, to be honest, you know, there's a challenge sometimes because while we did partner with them, we were coming from very different perspectives. And what we had to put aside perhaps was the differences and really focus on, okay, we actually want the same thing here. We know we're stronger together. We know we're not necessarily aligned on everything, nor do we need to be, but we are aligned on this issue. How do we work together to achieve real change on that issue? So I think that it's such a interesting example. And it certainly got the attention of media. I mean, I think that idea of these unlikely bedfellows really did get some interest, and it took the fancy, I suppose, of media outlets who were keen to cover this unusual collection of groups working so clearly and I think really quite well towards a common goal.
Yeah, I mean, we had some less surprising coalition partners, obviously, with other animal protection organisations, which, again, I just cherish so much. I think the more that we can do that for every issue, the better. And, I think another one was certainly the Body Shop, Emily. I'm sure you'll remember that, where, you know, that, I haven't had an experience like that since, where we just had so much support. I think at the time we had, there was 80 Body Shop stores and they had pledged to support our live sheep export campaign and were literally signing up people to join our petition, but in a really unique way of they were actually signing little pieces of paper that were structures that could turn into a link. And our campaign at the time had a creative angle of what we called the humane chain, and every link in the chain was representing somebody who was against live sheep export. And so the Body Shop was signing up these people on these little cardboard structures and they were turning them into chains, and those chains were just exploding throughout the stores. So I would go and visit the stores and there was these red, big, bold links everywhere. And that was phenomenal. It really shook the industry as well. We got quite a bit of media coverage from that too. And yeah, that was just phenomenal. And they did that again for us a couple of years later and just drove, I think it was hundreds of thousands of people to sign that petition at the time. So that was very cool and something I will remember for a long time.
It really shows the power, doesn't it, of corporates with the great reach that they have. You know, quite often their reach is far beyond that of a social change organisation, certainly beyond ours. So for us to be able to find that alignment between the good that they were wanting to do in the world at the time, the Body Shop, and the work that we were doing, I think that, you know, that coming together, I suppose, and using the strengths that they had with the strength of the campaign that we were delivering. It was wonderful too. It had that amazing sort of offline component, as you said, stores being filled with these red paper chains. Even the visuals are amazing, and the Body Shop stores would sometimes have to clean them out and start again because they just had too many links in the chain and they had to sell products. So that, you know, what a wonderful problem to have. But there was also the online component, and as you said, that creative concept was the idea of a humane chain of people in support of protecting Australian sheep. So, you know, we had this online component, which then saw this red chain as people signed up to the campaign, they'd be a point on the map, and then this chain would join people across Australia. So really, really powerful. And of course, you know, while we can't be complacent, there are two things about wins. One, it's never one effort, it's never one organisation. It's always the case that there are many people fighting the good fight. I think in our case, we're just really happy to have played a part in that, recognising all the other amazing animal welfare organisations that fought and continue to fight that. But the second thing too is that when you have wins, you can't rest on those wins. You have to stay vigilant. And I think that the live export example is a great case in point. Jess, you sort of talk a little bit about what sort of the most recent development is with the live export trade and the commitment to end it, but then also maybe some of the sort of current pushback that we're seeing.
Yeah, I mean, it's not an issue that I'm directly working on right now, but I'm very much watching, especially as having, you know, spent a few years dedicated to that. But yeah, right now, obviously, we are at a wonderful position in that, you know, all the groups that are working on it have managed to get the Labor Party to make a commitment to end live export. I think it's by 2028. The coalition, they have said that they would flip that ban over and that trajectory over, which is obviously really scary for everybody working on the issue and certainly not the outcome that we want to see for animals involved. It really is a hellish issue that animals have to go through. But yeah, exactly. It's a good example to show that even if you get those wins, even politically, even when you have these commitments by government, you know, the next government can come in and flip those things over. And that just shows, I think, ultimately what we really always want is actually culture change. And we want the community to be on board with our issues. So, yeah, unfortunately, it's not a process of, you know, change always goes in one direction. It can unfortunately go back the other way.
Absolutely, absolutely. And in the course of your career, you've worked on so many different elements of campaigning, haven't you? So, you know, many examples of when that's been about advocating with governments for that legislative change or policy change. In addition, it's been public mobilisation, looking at changing the expectations that in our case in Australia, but beyond, that people have about, in this instance, about animals, about the way that we treat animals and the standards that we expect. And so really shifting that public awareness, public perception, and then the expectation that publics have about how animals or people, and this is true for all campaigning, but the standards that we accept. But a huge part, and from what I understand, a growing part of your work between the time that we were together at World Animal Protection and now, has really been a strong focus on engaging with corporates and driving change through that engagement, through shifting their policies, through shifting their procurement, for example. Can you tell me why? And potentially that links to your previous point, but what has been the driver in that shift towards a greater focus on corporates for you?
Yeah, I think focusing on legislation or corporates or awareness or behaviour change, you know, they all have a role. It's really about thinking about what the issue is that you're trying to tackle. And in where I'm working now, so for Four Paws International, we have a team focused on the textiles industry, a team which I lead, and we are really working to protect animals from cruelty in those supply chains. The most vulnerable part of that supply chain is brands. And brands that are public facing that consumers can actually see that they have some kind of recognition of and have an influence on. So we have chosen to tackle brands. Obviously, we can tackle legislation, and we do. That is still part of our work for sure. But a big part of our work is tackling corporates and brands, particularly on the fashion industry, which I would say is a little different to the food industry. Particularly on the fashion industry, their value is around their brand. It's around, you know, the mystery behind their products, or physically people, there's a lot of people in the world that like to have a logo on their clothes. And so that has a huge role to play when it comes to reputation. There's obviously all industries can suffer from credibility damage, but the fashion industry is particularly vulnerable to it. And so we saw that's the best place to put our attention and effort. And that's why we focus on corporates, because if you tarnish the brand, you're really tarnishing the value of their product. And that's pretty easy to do in the fashion industry.
And what sort of, and this is a broad question, I imagine that you have a mix of responses from corporates, but can you just talk a little bit about, you know, when you do engage with a corporate, how you go about it? I mean, it sort of links into this question of organizations, whether they position themselves as an insider organization, which is sort of more on-site and supporting, maybe guiding corporates or governments, but also the counter to that being an outsider organization where you may be from afar agitating for change. And we've got a question around, what do you think is most effective, taking that more insider approach, being an outsider, or do we even need to decide? Can you do both?
Oh, good questions. I do believe you can be both. I think you can apply external pressure but still hold that conversation. And I think we're seeing that more and more, and certainly experienced CSR professionals that all sit inside companies, they're almost trained to know how to handle pressure from externals but still hold the conversation as well. And generally, you know, I would say that's a lot of what companies are. Some companies will have, I believe, almost probably a rule just not to engage with charities or any stakeholder groups that are lobbying against them. I think they have a rule of just shutting them out and hoping that they go away. And I think there's some that are just very inexperienced and they're just so scared to engage and they just won't, particularly if you're a threatening organization. So there is definitely those two ends of the spectrum, but I would say a large majority are still happy to have the conversation no matter where you are. I think it's pretty hard to completely lead with a carrot and have no stick. I do think that's quite difficult to do. I think there's a role to play for some organizations to be super industry friendly. But in my experience, and certainly in our work at Four Paws, we do both. So we always say we're happy to have the conversation, happy to give support. We have experts on hand ready to support policy development and give all that advice. But at the same time, if you're really doing the wrong thing and you're not playing ball, we will show that to the world, and we'll highlight the problems, and we'll bring those issues to the consumer's attention. And that also really helps to give those CSR professionals that you're generally dealing with, or it's the comms or PR people within those companies, a reason to actually act. You know, they need to have a consequence, and then they can say, hey CEO or hey board, you know, we need to jump on this. Otherwise we're going to suffer the consequences. And it's not just an altruistic act if you give them that. So yeah, so we do play on both sides, and I think that works really, really well.
And it's an interesting point. They're thinking about, you know, corporate engagement, but corporates are just people, and they're people in different roles with different agendas and different jobs to do. And I think it's a really interesting point there about, you might have people within the organization, within the company, that actually do want to make the change. And in a way, if it's working well, then you can support them with the arguments, with the evidence, and with the risk of the consequences if change doesn't happen. And we certainly see that in a government context as well. I've had many occasions where I'll be working with departmental staff and they may be looking to make change and make improvements in animal welfare in this case, but actually the animal welfare sector can play an important role. And this translates across any sector, but we're talking about animal welfare in this context, that those organisations can actually provide the data, the evidence, the arguments, but often it's people within corporates or within government that are then making the change and stepping through the process to making improvements. And you've reminded me of another example, and it's not in the corporate context, it's looking at government engagement, but just how you can strike that balance of being insider, outsider, you know, and that's a very simplified binary. However, I think it's really helpful just as a tool to think about how an organization positions itself and potentially moves along that trajectory. When we were working in China and we worked on a number of animal welfare issues in China, one being the farming of bears for their bile. So again, amongst many other organizations that have done and continue to do amazing work in that respect, Animals Asia to name one, and maybe the most prominent. But the time where we were working and contributing to change, we were finding that the governments didn't want to talk to us about bear bile, but they did want to talk to us about the work we were doing to make improvements to the welfare of farmed pigs. So we had teams that had technical expertise, that veterinarians who could advise on how to, in the farm situation, to improve the welfare and the experience of those pigs. So we're two different issues, but one stakeholder, really, one big stakeholder, the government of China and various ministries and departments within that. But we were continually walking that line between we're agitating for change here in one way around bear bile, and we're also agitating for change around farmed pigs, but we were doing it in a very different way and managing to walk that line. Of course, key in that is having the right advice, particularly for different cultural contexts, and making sure that, you know, you're taking the best advice to walk that what can be sometimes a tricky line. What would you say are some of the keys to successful corporate campaigning?
Well, so much thinking about your examples there in China, Emily, not an easy place to navigate and probably a lot more complicated than corporate change. I think one thing I like about corporate campaigning is that it generally is a stakeholder, you know, it's one company. If we break it down for one company at a time, it is more simple. You know, and you can achieve lots of change, you know, if you're going after one company and the next and next and next. There's lots of wins as well, which is really nice to keep our teams motivated and they can see those changes, unlike that amazing legislative change or government change that we want to see. But to get that to happen, I do think there is some key things that you need to really think about. And certainly one of them is just thinking about what is going to drive that company. And again, I mentioned about fashion companies that they are really vulnerable to credibility attacks. So for us, that's definitely something that we keep in mind as a tool in our toolbox. For other corporates, it might be something different. So what's motivating them? Again, for fashion companies, brand reputation is sort of everything. I think we've seen that recently as well with Tesla is another example, with everything that's going on in America and Elon Musk and criticism around those actions and then the dive in Tesla sales. I think that's, you know, a really recent example that we can all
absolutely
seen in the newspapers recently. So that idea of boycotting companies, it's still incredibly powerful tool as well. I mean, you have to do that carefully. There is laws around boycotts too, particularly for a big charity or small ones, you know, you need to keep those things in mind. But ultimately that does happen when companies face those reputational risks. People just either just don't want to have those products in their home or don't want to be supporting those companies. So yeah, so it's an interesting tool there. And certainly public pressure, people just calling for change is a really great way to move corporate. We've obviously experimented over the years with different tactics as well. One example was last year, and a couple of colleagues in my team who are really involved in the Fur Free Alliance, they, together with lots of groups, again, another big global collaboration, they were tackling Max Mara, which is a company that quite a high-end fashion brand that was still, as of last year, selling fur. I started out by sending emails to their company, so globally, everybody mobilizing their supporters to do that. And they weren't getting a lot of traction. Then they flipped to, there were some members of that coalition actually campaigning out front of stores, and that seemed to really grab the attention of that brand. And also then moving supporters to actually make comments on the social media channels of that company, that actually really seemed to make some change too. So whilst the emails are great at letting companies know, and the companies will start to think, oh, there's a problem here, but it's they'll really be thinking about that in terms of the actual people that sent them those emails. It's at that point not affecting their brand. So that's why, you know, it was then decided to leap to something that would really hit them in that place that would grab their attention and justify them making the commitment to end their use of fur, which they did, which was great. So yeah, I guess you really have to think through what's going to move them when you design out those tactics as well as the overarching strategy.
And it speaks to the question, doesn't it, of tipping point. I think that, you know, so many of these campaigns that we fight, they run for years. I mean, sometimes we have quick wins and fabulous, but quite often, I think because organisations are rightly tackling the big issues, they're tackling the issues where they can create the most change for the most number of animals, often means then that the drivers of the problem are entrenched, and these campaigns are, you know, often long campaigns and they're hard fought and they're hard won campaigns. So often it's not one thing, is it? It's multiple things. I want to come to the question of your experience of a tipping point moment. But before we do, there's one piece I really want to understand a little bit better. When you talk about the different tools that campaigners can use to demonstrate social support or public outcry, public motivation for change, that's obviously like a continually evolving landscape, isn't it? So, you know, I think back to a couple of decades ago, generally what you were using was the, you know, the mass email to a politician. And that still happens, that the organizations are still using that. But obviously since then, there's been the advent and growth of various social media channels, but also more sophisticated ways for people to take action. Yeah, there's always a question around what is meaningful action. And I know that when we are looking for things that people can do, so someone's cares about an issue, they want to do something, it's really incumbent upon the campaigner to ensure that the thing that the person does is meaningful, and that while one person on their own may not change things when we've got large scale change that we're looking for, but it is important that action that the person takes does contribute to achieving change. So that's an authentic, it's a meaningful contribution that they can make. And so I'm curious about the different ways in which people can take action and how that's changing in terms of what's available to us, but also what's available to, for example, the corporates to mitigate some of that social action. What have you noticed has changed over the last, you know, 10 to 20 years?
Gosh, I mean, a lot has changed and some things haven't. You know, fundamental principles are still the same, but certainly the technology, oh gosh, there's so much change in the last 10 years on that front. I mean, I still remember Emily, our director, would come over every now and then with a sheet of newspaper saying, oh, check out this. And we'd read a physical bit of paper that she'd bring over to us. I mean, you just don't do that anymore. It's changed so much in that way. And I mean, it's brought opportunity, but it's still, you know, it was fraught with challenges. So social media is amazing in that, you know, the accessibility to people and to stakeholders and organizations. I mean, I use LinkedIn, for example, to reach out to particular professionals within companies that I want to engage with, which we would never have had before. You know, you can literally find out who in that company you want to talk to. You know, it's not just the board who are on the website anymore. You can see where everybody, basically every professional in the world, who they're working for and whereabouts they're based. And so, I mean, that level of information and access is something that we have never had before. Everything keeps moving as always. And I mean, the other issue we have is whilst there is all this access and opportunity, that's the same for everybody. And so now there is so much noise and getting that cut through and so then still getting through is still a challenge. And we're always now having to deal with, you know, certain social media platforms are becoming sort of silos in themselves. There's the progressive social media platforms or media platforms. We've always had papers having a big media moguls having a certain outlook on what they wanted to report on, but they were generally still accessible by everyone. Whereas now we're really just getting a certain feed and a certain type of information, and all the algorithms are having a really big role to play. But we don't just want to talk to our own audiences or the converted. We want to reach out across those barriers. And that's a new issue that we have to deal with and learn about now. And again, something that MPs and companies, they're aware of those things too. So we can be kind of shut out from conversations at the same time. So many different things going on now, and it's quite a different place to operate in a sense, but still those foundational things are so important. You know, you have to get people advocating. We still want to see marches out in the street. We still want to see people doing live actions. Petitions are still a meaningful tool. You know, even from a government level, some governments have got structures in place. You know, if you get 100,000 signatures on something, it has to go to Parliament, or in the EU, it's over 1 million, and they will have like a European discussion about that in European Parliament. So these are still meaningful instruments that people can take part of and weigh in. For sure, there is some petitions that don't really go anywhere, and they are a data capture tool, which is, you know, okay, so long as you're then taking them on a journey to do something meaningful. And yeah, so, you know, I think all of those things can still come into play. It's choosing the right thing, but I absolutely agree. You do want to have meaningful actions, because you'll lose people so quickly. And ultimately, people can do little things, right? They can share something on social media. They can repost something. They're still taking actions, and they're still really helpful. And I think a lot of the time we want people to do those things. But ultimately, you know, getting people to go and meet with their MP, writing to the editor of a newspaper, you know, that those things still happen. You can still get papers to print your opinion, and writing letters that are really meaningfully well done and unique to your MP or to brands. They're all still things that still, you know, are recognized. So whilst the industry has changed, how we can reach people has changed so much. Getting people to do meaningful action, I mean, that's still so vital, and we can still find a way for that to happen.
It's a great reminder, isn't it? I think that anybody working in campaigning, of course, you need to be really astute in looking at how the world is changing around us. And that's not just technology, it's government priorities, it's shifting in priorities, but also we need to be agile. It's so important to have your strategy and have the theory of change mapped out, be really clear on what the problem is, what drives it, how you as a campaigner can tackle that. But of course, we have to be agile. And sometimes things come left of field, both in a good way and in a not so good way. ChatGPT is an example of that, certainly when it comes to how we communicate about. But to bring us to a close, and again, just to come back to that question of the tipping point, I'd love to hear an example. I mean, you've got probably so many that you could draw from, but an example of a campaigning success that you have been part of, and thinking about what the change you were setting out to achieve, and then what was the tipping point that actually moved that from an issue you need to work on to one where you got traction and then ultimately success?
There's so many campaigns I've been part of and or watch from the sidelines as well. It's so great to see those wins, and you see them all the time. Just before I move to that, you know, the idea of designing that campaign from the outset is and carefully doing that is so important. And picking your target that your organization has the appetite to tackle, because these things can take an extraordinary amount of time, or they can be quite short, or they can be really scary, and the person that you're going against is really combative. Like, is that the sort of tone of your organization, or are you, you know, a different type of organization that needs to deal with stakeholders that are less going to bring those challenges to you? So I think, you know, choosing your stakeholders wisely and planning out your campaigning according to your team's appetite, or if you're an individual campaigner, what you can actually do is so important, because you also don't want to walk away from a campaign and let people off the hook. And then later on they think, oh, well, that's all we need to do. We can just ignore those things. We don't want that to happen. And that's where I think designing that from the outset is really important. But yeah, in terms of one example, I guess one that happened just recently, and certainly not something that Four Paws did on its own, was seeing, so the ultimate achievement that happened is H&M ended its use of virgin feathers. So there's, I think, they're still going to use recycled down feathers, so from ducks and geese to a degree, but using those virgin feathers that had never been used before. And why Four Paws is interested in that issue is because there's an issue of live plucking that goes on today around the world, still happens. So ducks and geese are plucked alive for their feathers, and they do that increasingly because the more you pluck the birds, the finer the feathers get. And the higher the quality gets is the theory. But obviously that's incredibly traumatic for those animals and something that we've been calling for an end to for a long time. And so we have been talking to H&M for a long time. Their staff are very happy to have a conversation, and we've spoken to them for so many years on all sorts of issues, including this one. We have developed a platform called the Wear It Kind Directory, and we do profile how brands are tracking on that issue, but also on live lamb cutting, which you can look up and learn about, and on fur, which most of your listeners, I'm sure, will know about already, and also how brands are working to reduce their use of animal derived materials. So there's four things that we look at there. And with down, Four Paws is an animal welfare organization. And so there is a distinction there between animal welfare and animal rights. They have different roles to play. But in the textile space, I would say Four Paws is one of the most active animal welfare organizations for sure on protecting animals in the textile supply chains. And PETA would be the most active animal rights organizations. And there's been times where our efforts have overlapped. And this is an instance where that certainly happened. So PETA was campaigning quite heavily for H&M to dump their use of feathers altogether. They did some brilliant campaigning around just really bringing attention to this issue. They have had several investigations highlighting that, you know, this cruelty, live plucking, but all sorts of down, you know, suffering from geese and ducks. Four Paws has done a similar thing, slightly different messaging, but that all did converge over the last couple of years. With our Wear It Kind directory, we basically said to the brand, including H&M, unfortunately, the certifications that are out there today are not mitigating that issue of live plucking well enough, adequately, let's say. So essentially, a big part of the risk of live plucking is happening when there's geese and ducks in the supply chain that are called parent farms, and they create the eggs that then go off to fattening farms and are used for meat production. But it's quite a high risk time for geese and ducks in those parent farms because they're there for a long time. And so the farmers can pluck them more and more and more. And unfortunately, that part of the supply chain is left out of those certifications. They find it really difficult to go right back to the beginning of the supply chain. But what that means is all those certifications cannot really say that the entire supply chain is live plucking free, and they are leaving out that high risk end of the supply chain. So we went to H&M and other brands and explained that quite factually to them, you know, what is going on. Unfortunately, there isn't a solution to deal with that and to continue using down and feathers from ducks and geese, unless they were prepared to do a whole lot of effort and really map their supply chain right back to those parent farms and put other things in place, which most brands just don't have the capacity to do. So the choice really is to move to alternatives. And there are so many alternatives now for feathers. So there's obviously the synthetic ones, but there's these amazing plant-based alternatives coming through also. So we provided all of that information to them, put the pressure on by the Wear It Kind directory and certainly via our consumers also sharing their thoughts, taking the Wear It Kind pledge, for example. But then PETA obviously came in with really great coverage and pressure from the outside and all those things converging, including H&M staff actually engaging with us and learning about the issue and putting effort in themselves. And they're a really big organization, taking that up to management and having those discussions internally. All of those things coming together did lead them to make that decision, which was wonderful. And we all celebrated, and it was just great to have that win.
That's an amazing example. And, you know, just as you're describing it, even though it's an issue I'm familiar with, when you hear that description of what these animals endure time and time again, the significance of that win is just so evident that this means that those animals don't have to experience the pain and suffering. And I think that anything where we're making improvements for animals, for people, it's a long road. There are others that are continuing to perpetuate cruelty and suffering, and this is one piece of a much bigger puzzle. But what a huge piece, and how fantastic to be able to to claim that, to celebrate that. And when I say claim that, I mean claim that for everyone who was involved. And I think if there's probably one message to come out of our conversation today, it is the power of unified effort. It's the power of coming together, and often that is people working within the same sector. It's in this case other animal welfare organisations operating potentially at different points and always with different approaches, but the power of them coming together. But more than that, it is a power of uniting with these other allies. So be that people within corporates, be it others like our example from earlier, the Meat Workers Union. Of course, we're never afraid to call out cruelty, to call out when something needs to change. But if there is a path and you can motivate stakeholders and a mix of stakeholders to come together for change, then not only do you create the change, but that potentially you then start to create that culture shift, which you spoke about earlier, Jess, right? That if you've got an advocate within H&M or another corporate or a government, that these people become advocates for that issue, but they maybe become advocates for your cause far beyond. You know, once this issue is solved, and we're always keeping watch that we don't slide back, but that actually what we're wanting to do is to equip others to continue to fight the good fight. You know, we need all of us and more to tackle the issues that we're looking at, whether that be environment, animals, people, whole range of issues. The more of us are working and fighting the good fight, the better. So I think that's a really beautiful and positive note to end on. I'm looking at that success and that win. Was there anything else you wanted to add before we draw the conversation to a close?
No, it was just a lot of fun to reflect with you, Emily. We have known each other for a long time, but it was so special to have you as my first line manager, and that was just an amazing experience. And it's been so great to see all the things that you've worked on as well over this time. We could have talked forever about the things that you have worked on that I watched you work on that I wasn't as closely working on too. So that's been a really good experience, and so fun to have this chat with you today.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Jess. And I think you've spoken there to sort of the reason behind this podcast, which is that there are so many people doing great work, often as part of teams, but not always. This work can sometimes be isolating. You're dealing with really tough subjects, right? You're dealing in this case with suffering of animals on a huge scale. And so there's trauma involved in that, and there's isolation. And so part of this podcast is about saying, let's have a conversation. Let's talk about what works or what doesn't work. And let's together sort of feel part of a community. Because even if we're not in the same organization, we're not even working in the same sector, the community is doing great work. And so this is a chance to really have conversations about that work and together or get better and smarter at the work that we do. So it's been an absolute delight to have this conversation with you, and thank you so much, Jess.
Oh, thanks, Emily. Looking forward to hearing future episodes.
And great thanks to our listeners for joining us. Let's continue and grow this conversation. We'd love you to subscribe and to share the podcast link with others. To find out more, visit agencyinternational.com.au. Until next time, I'm Emily Reeves, and you've been listening to Agency.